The Brad Sesmat Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Say one thing for Brad Sesmat. He knows when to take time off. Why'd you leave me with this, Brad? Good morning. I'm Jeff Munn, radio voice of ASU women's basketball, stadium voice of Phoenix Rising FC. I lose track of what I'm doing, but it gets the bills paid, and so we're here. And good morning, and nice to have you with us on a Wednesday on the Brad Sesmat Show. We come to you on sports360az.com, azcentralsports.com. We have what is known in the business as a loaded show. Greg Esposito, the sports Suns columnist for sports360az.com, longtime member of the Suns front office, will join us to talk about the story that broke last night about former Suns general manager, president of basketball operations, and current president of basketball operations with the Philadelphia 76ers, Brian Colangelo. We'll get you some of the details on that in a second. Ed Graney, outstanding columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Obviously, game two of the Stanley Cup Finals is tonight. The Vegas Golden Knights are three wins away from a Stanley Cup. But I want to talk to Ed about the bigger picture with this in terms of what kind of impact the fan reaction to the Vegas Golden Knights is having with the two leagues who are not either there or coming there, and that would be the NBA and Major League Baseball. Our buddy Tim Kempton, Suns radio analyst, will join us to share his thoughts about the NBA Finals, which start tomorrow night, and then talk to the Lopes, our weekly Wednesday feature, and our dear friend, GCULopes.com reporter Paul Coro. We'll kind of go over a busy year academically, athletically for Grand Canyon University and a little look ahead to next year. So we got a lot to get to. Let's get right to it. The day's news and sports is brought to you by Sagic Cornell. I listen on the podcast to Brad quite often and try to catch the show on the website. And I've heard him talk about in the past how important it is for guys who are just starting out with their families to think about, and you have to think about this, what happens if? Well, the people at Sagic Cornell, and if you go to sagiccornell.com, you can find out how easy it is to protect your family in case something happens. It is not an overwhelming thing. It's very easy to set up. And as I've said many times when I host this show, what you're really investing in is peace of mind, not only for you, but the people you love. So we hope you'll visit sagiccornell.com, and we thank them for their support of sports360az.com. I use Twitter for information, and I will post things from time to time. I posted about 20 minutes ago that I was going to do this show. But I'm not the most savvy Twitter person in the world. So when I hear the slang terms being used for Twitter, I'm going to get Eric Sorensen in on this because he's the tech-savvy guy around here. They were using a term last night for anonymous Twitter accounts, and it's, what is it? It's, I don't know the word.
Is it catfishing?
I think so. Well, in any event, and I don't know if we don't have enough time to get into this in total detail, but
because do you understand what catfishing is, right?
No.
Catfishing is essentially another word for trolling. When you are creating, whether it be a Facebook account, a Twitter account, a fake Instagram account, and you're using someone else's likeness as your own, you're acting as someone else, even though they are not you.
But that's not really what this was. What it was.
In a way, it was.
Yeah,
but
in
I'll
a way.
I'll let you continue, because there are so many layers on the story.
A report by The Ringer, which I assume is a media website.
It is. It
cites circumstantial evidence that paints a picture of Brian Colangelo, the 76ers president of basketball operations, using multiple anonymous Twitter accounts. And on those accounts, some take shots at some of his team's players, including Joel Embiid and Markelle Fultz, as well as former Sixers Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens Noel. And according to the story, some of the Twitter posts are also critical of Sixers head coach Brett Brown. Now, the account that is referenced most often is at Phila, P-H-I-L-A, 1234567. Brian issued a statement last night, and I'm going to read from it. Like many of my colleagues in sports, I've used social media as a means to keep up with the news. While I have never posted anything whatsoever on social media, I have used the aforementioned Twitter account referenced in the story to monitor our industry and other current events. The storyline is disturbing to me on many levels, and I am not familiar with any of the other accounts that have been brought to my attention, nor do I know who is behind them or what their motives may be in using them. The Sixers have said they will investigate this. They'll use an outside investigator to get to the bottom of this. This is tough. I'm going to say this up front. I worked for Brian Colangelo. I consider myself a friend of Brian Colangelo's. I'm an admirer of his. This is not the easiest thing for me to discuss because I do have some amount of bias. I do care about Brian a great deal. But facts are facts, or stories are stories in this case. We haven't gotten to the facts yet. But if there is any truth to this, Eric, this is really not good.
And I think BC's statement was probably about 35% true. Because you have to understand, Jeff, the one thing that I was talking to a friend about this last night, how many hours did the Ringer put in to researching and eventually breaking something like this? I mean, you're talking about five different Twitter. I mean, if these allegations are true, Brian Colangelo was essentially juggling five different Twitter handles.
Yeah.
And like you said, backstabbing his head coach, backstabbing players, backstabbing former players, arguing with fans on social media. But you'd have to think, if the Ringer didn't think there was some serious legs behind this, they would never put something like this out there. And in reading these tweets, it's just I don't know. Like, I don't know Brian nearly as well as you do, but I know he had some very strange idiosyncrasies when he was with the Suns. He never got his dad's PR savvy, and I think that's safe to say.
No,
he did not like being the public figure like his dad.
No, you're right. He was less comfortable with it. But here's what I can tell you about this. And I know him. I will own up to the fact that I probably know him better because I worked for him. But I don't know him intimately. And he and I have not had a regular communicative relationship in 10, 12 years. What I know of him is this. When he worked in the front office with the Suns, nobody worked harder than Brian Colangelo. No one in that office had more respect from the staff than Brian Colangelo. We all knew who he was, but he never made it a big deal. And what they're saying about this, to some degree, runs counter to the Brian Colangelo that I worked for and knew. I'm not saying it's not true. Let's let the investigation run its course, and we'll get to the bottom of it. But there is that potential that if there is truth to this, it's not good for Brian Colangelo, who at the end of the day is a very good person. And he's certainly an outstanding basketball executive. He's won NBA Executive of the Year with two different franchises. Maybe a third would have been in line with Philadelphia. So we shall see. Stanley Cup Finals, Game 2 tonight. Vegas leads Washington 1-0. We'll get into more of that with Ed Graney later on in the show. A couple other things I want to hit very quickly. Ray Anderson, Vice President of University Athletics at ASU, press conference yesterday to confirm that Tracy Smith will continue as baseball coach. It was an interesting press conference, and Ray was very direct in addressing some things, said things have got to improve. We have to pitch better, we have to have better defense, and we have to have better overall results on the field. And his statement was 2019 is a very important year. I don't think anybody's going to dispute that, including Tracy Smith. And Ray Anderson also reaffirmed that he understands how important baseball is at Arizona State University to the fan base. And all I'm going to say is this. Those people who feel that Ray doesn't understand that, they're wrong. He does get it. He is very aware of the importance to the soul of ASU that baseball is, and its history and its legacy. You know who else understands it? Tracy Smith. Now, I'm not here to defend either one of these gentlemen. All I'm saying is those of you who think that either one of these gentlemen are kind of out of touch with the importance of baseball to this school, you're wrong. They do understand the importance of it. And Tracy Smith will be the first to say, next year's a very important year. He's right in step with Ray on it. And to me, you've gone down the road in rebuilding this roster. To change now may not be the best thing in the world for the immediate prospects of the program. Now, next year is next year, and depending on what happens, we'll see. That's about all you can say at this point. Quickly, D-backs got another win last night over Cincinnati. I went to the game, and I'm just a quick thought. Two things. One, the Reds are – it's been a rough year for the Reds. They've already changed managers. They're just not playing very good baseball. That's not to say the D-backs haven't improved in some areas. They are hitting the ball a little bit better. Gosh, against the pitching that's been rolled out, they better hit the ball better. This is a homestand for them to kind of build up their confidence, Cincinnati and Miami. Quick thought, we'll go to break. The interesting part of the D-backs between now and July 31st will not necessarily be what they do on the field. It'll be what they do in the front office. Mike Hazen has some really interesting decisions to make. Not all of them are going to be pleasant. And that's what's going to form the storyline of the D-backs the rest of 2018. Greg Esposito on what we can talk about at this point about the story involving Brian Colangelo. That's up next on the Brad Sesmatch Show, sports360az.com, azcentralsports.com. You know, it's after Memorial Day. It's the quiet time of the year in sports. That's not the case. And Greg Esposito, Suns columnist for sports360az.com, joins us. I wish all we had to talk about was Cleveland Golden State round four and the number one draft pick for the Suns. But Espo, there was a story last night. I don't even know where to begin with this. I don't know how much interaction. Tell me, first of all, were you in the Suns organization when Brian was still there?
I was not. I joined during the Lance Blanks era, however you want to say it. So that was my time, a little after Brian's time with the team.
I can tell you that what I'm reading, and if you're just joining us, there is a story that Sixers president of basketball operations and former Suns president of basketball operations, Brian Colangelo, has been using anonymous Twitter accounts to be very critical of players, former players, coaches, what have you. That does not – now, granted, I worked for Brian and knew him when there was no Twitter. So I can't sit there and say, gee, never used it when he was here. But that kind of behavior to me, Espo, is not consistent with the Brian Colangelo I knew and worked for.
He wasn't sending anonymous faxes back then before Twitter?
No, not that I'm aware of. Go ahead.
The whole thing sounds a little crazy to me, to be honest. But it's not like the Ringer kind of went with some half baked story. They got this tip back in February and actually did some investigative work. And if you read the piece, Colangelo actually admits that one of the five Twitter accounts that they were looking at actually was his. And then after the Ringer reached out to the Sixers, suddenly the remainder of those accounts stopped tweeting. It's just the most bizarre thing I've ever heard, and I don't know why an NBA executive would ever put their career on the line to tweet these kind of things. And the most bizarre one was arguing with a guy about the size of the collars on his dress shirt. I mean, if this really is Brian Colangelo, there's something majorly wrong there. It's bizarre.
Brian, yeah, I've never known, and again, I haven't had a working relationship with Brian since 2003. I never knew him to get that worried about what people thought of his attire. But I think there's a bigger picture issue, at least, or a bigger picture story here, and you just touched on it. We're in a day and age where there are way more media outlets. A lot of them are through the internet. They're not print. They're not broadcast. They're specific. They're niche services. We have them with the Suns here. And you're right. It's hard to believe, A, that Brian Colangelo would have been involved in something like this. But conversely, it's also hard to believe that the Ringer would go with this story unless they had credible evidence. And I think this gets back into something that's popped up a number of times over the last couple of years, the legitimacy and the journalistic integrity of non-traditional media outlets.
Well, if there were certain outlets that were reporting this, I'd be skeptical. If this were some fan blog or it were some, I don't know. There's plenty of those sites out there, and there's a handful of them with the Suns that if you look at their Twitter accounts and the kind of articles they're writing, you can go, okay, I wouldn't trust this place if they reported this about somebody in the Suns organization. But when it's the Ringer, and they took the time to legitimately go through this, that's why I wonder about it. My guess is if it's not Brian, it's somebody within the organization or somebody who used to be with the organization that had an axe to grind, that knew certain things and the cadence of the way Brian Colangelo would write, because they very much, all five of these accounts kind of mashed up in the way that they talked and they spoke. The thing to me that is the craziest of all this is I get paid to run social media accounts for my day job, mm-hmm. and I don't have the time to run five of them, five Twitter accounts and run them and tweet as often as supposedly Brian Colangelo did, according to this reporting. It's crazy that somebody would have that much time to do these and follow that many random media members and different people and leak the kind of information that they did. The whole talk about I'm blanking on the forward's name right now. Sorry, but that
Joel and
the
players that were mentioned were like Nerlens Noel, Okafor, Embiid.
Okafor, who was thinking.
Yeah.
Where they were trying to say, these accounts just kept bringing up the fact that Okafor had failed a physical and it caused a trade to basically fall apart, which was crazy because nobody else was reporting this, and these accounts kept pushing that information. If it's true and that did come from a Colangelo, that's a big issue that you're releasing information. I still don't think it was Brian Colangelo himself. It just doesn't make a lot of sense that somebody would be that petty with that high of a job, a title, and what he has to do as president of basketball operations. But this is probably one of the more random social media stories we've heard in a while involving sports.
I agree. And Greg Esposito, Sports360AZ.com Suns columnist, joins us. For a little background, and I know that while you didn't work with Brian, you're very familiar with his track record. Won Executive of the Year here. Won Executive of the Year in Toronto with the Raptors, and in Philadelphia, when he got that job, the Philadelphia media immediately pounced on it, said he's just getting the job because he's Jerry's son, and Jerry is a consultant with the Sixers, and they were still very, like, this is Sam Hinkie's team and his process and his plan. And just at the end of this regular season, Greg, I went on the Philadelphia Inquirer website, and you could see the town had changed, was starting to change its opinion on Brian. The timing of this, I just feel sick about it, because they were starting to understand what I think a lot of us in basketball knew, that despite the fact that he's lived in the shadow of his dad for a long time, Brian Colangelo is a solid basketball executive.
Well, and he fought those claims of nepotism here in Phoenix, too, mm-hmm. and did the job superbly. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Thing is, Sam Hinkie may have been good at coming up with a plan to accumulate young talent, but that doesn't mean he knew how to put together a team. And I think that's what Brian did. He took that next step of going, okay, there's assets here, there's young talent, but how do we make this a winning team? And people looked at that J.J. Redick contract, 20-plus million for 1 year, and went, this is insane. But that was the kind of guy that you bring in, knows how to win, has been there, has been to the playoffs, and he helps those young guys understand what it takes to take that next step for Philly, and he did great. And the other thing that $20 million contract did, and it's probably a lesson he learned from his father is now JJ has an affinity towards that front office and the 76ers, and the chance that he signs a much more affordable 2-3-4-year deal to stay in Philadelphia is much higher now because you took that chance, you gave him the money. It's kind of the reverse of what happened with Danny Manning here in Phoenix, where it was, hey, take a lower deal this year, we'll get you on the back end. It was, take it up front, and we're going to wind up keeping you around here to be part of something special. Brian knows what he's doing. That's why
he does.
It doesn't make sense that you would get that hurt by things and run these kind of accounts to defend yourself against Philly media and fans when you do know what you're doing and you're good at it. Like, I feel like Brian would know the work would speak for itself eventually. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's very odd. I am out of time. This show, we got tons of guests, and I wish we could go on a lot longer, but we got to move along. But certainly we'll see how this all unfolds. Espo, appreciate it. Good to talk to you, my friend.
Always good to talk to you, and I'm trying to figure out what your burner account is. Understand what beef you have with people. So.
Well, actually, my dog has an account. Stevie's going to do a burner account for me, and that's where you'll find all the things that you're not supposed to know. Greg, I appreciate it.
I look forward to it.
Talk to you soon. Greg Esposito, Sports360AZ.com, Suns columnist, and former Suns social media director. He has great insights on the NBA, so if you stick with Sports360AZ.com, you'll get great opinions and great insight from Greg. We're going to go to Las Vegas next. Ed Graney, columnist with the Las Vegas Review-Journal, will talk about the impact of the Golden Knights on other sports. That's next on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Welcome to another edition of Be Careful of What You Wish For. I'm sure the Las Vegas sports media was very excited when the NHL announced they were going to bring a team to Las Vegas, and the first time major pro sports was there. And now Ed Graney, the outstanding columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, is probably only sleeping 2 hours a night. And essentially, and I'm, by the way, Jeff Munn for Brad Sesmatch on the Brad Sesmatch Show on this Wednesday. But Ed Graney of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, are you sleeping at all, or are you just like working 24 hours a day right now?
That's a funny point, Jeff. I will say this. It was the last series against Winnipeg, and we were writing a headline afterwards. I forget what game it was. It might have been game four because they were going back to Winnipeg after that. And I sat down to write, and I looked at our beat writer because, you know, obviously as you write for the next day, you said what day the game was. I looked at him. I said, what day is it? And, we had, and both of us had absolutely no idea. So it's been a long run. I mean, these NHL playoffs, when they get this far, the team you have to follow gets this far. It can be a long run, but it certainly has energized this city to a level I've never seen it. And beyond, I think, even it's incomparable to probably what they even could have imagined had they, you know, if they even thought about getting this far. And obviously no one ever thought they'd get this far or even make the playoffs in the beginning. So, yeah, it's been a pretty amazing to watch this town embrace these guys like this.
And that's why I wanted to talk to you. And I know we had a visit on Brad's show a couple of years ago about the impact that pro sports would have on the city of Las Vegas and how it would change the city. I want to talk about what you just said, the way the community has embraced this team. And let me take it from this angle. What is your sense of how the two leagues that are not there, the NBA and Major League Baseball, do you get any sense from either corner as to how they're reacting to the way the community is embracing this hockey team?
Well, I think the NBA is watching carefully because you see there's a facility in place. They have their summer league here. USA Basketball's here. There's a lot of basketball in this town, collegially and professionally, and it is a basketball town. The Knights have changed that for the time being, but overall, in the long run, it's always been a basketball town. So if I'm the NBA, or if I'm a team that might be, you know, bleeding a little financially and is maybe looking to make a move, I think my eyes would go to this town first. I know people talk Seattle, Kansas City. I understand those points. But my guess is there are a lot of eyes in the NBA watching this and seeing how this town responds. It's fascinating. I've written this several times. I mean, I've always likened it to a perfect storm. And, you know, one was kind of the unfathomable sadness of the shooting.
Yes.
And what the shooting meant to this town and how these players reacted. And then obviously the other part is the winning that no one could have predicted. But when these guys, when the shooting happened, you know, the next day, not by Bill Foley or George McPhee, this was Marc-Andre Fleury, this was James Neal, this was Derek England, who makes his home here. They looked at each other and said, we have to do something. They were the first at blood banks. They were the first talking to first responders. They were the first talking to people who had lost loved ones. They were first in hospitals. And the town saw that from afar, about, like, who are these hockey players? We know we have a team now, but look how they are now embracing us. Well, then, of course, when they turn around and have a historic winning season, that then, you know, completes the storm with the joy part of it. So it could have never been predicted. Obviously, no one ever would want the shooting, and no one ever wants the city to go through what the city went through with that. Those guys, more than anyone in terms of the prominent people in town, stepped forward, and the town fell in love with them for that. And then obviously now they've kind of repaid the town with what is obviously a historic run to the final.
And we hear the stories, Ed, and Ed Greeney of the Las Vegas Review-Journal joins us. The large crowds outside T-Mobile that are watching the games on the big screen, there'll be a huge turnout tonight. I think that's the big indicator. You can sell out the building, and that's one thing, and that's impressive. But when you get the thousands of people in the middle of the strip, where there's a lot of other things to do, but they're going right to a big screen TV, that's the part that's the wow moment for me.
Yeah, it is. Outside T-Mobile at the D Hotel downtown at Red Rock, there are several watch parties around town where you have thousands and thousands congregating. What they've done is literally make thousands of folks, not only new hockey fans, it's a transient town. I do a radio show in here in Vegas with my co-host the show, Clay Baker. Clay comes from Detroit, so he's a hockey guy. There's a lot like him who are from other parts of the country who knew hockey. But then there are a lot of people like my wife, who's been married to a sports writer for 21 years, never cared a thing about sports, and now has never missed a game with these guys. And they have, that's more impressive to me. They have taken people in this town who have never really cared about sports and just completely transformed them into people who wear the gear, buy the gear, can't miss a game, know every hockey term now. You know, two games into the Ryan Reeves era, when they had lost both, I walked home and the wife screaming at me, trade that bump. Now, of course, she loves him because he scored two straight goals in playoff games.
Right.
So, you know, that's the kind of craziness at all levels this town has undergone with these guys. And like you said, the watch parties and the outside the arena, that's big time. And, of course, a couple of miles down the highway is the Raiders Stadium being built as we speak. And obviously it's the NFL and it's the biggest sport in America. And that will bring a whole other factor, obviously, to the town when that thing is built and they arrive in 2020.
You read my mind, but not so much about the Raiders. I've had a theory, and I don't remember that we talked about this the last time you and I visited. It's my theory, Ed, that when they cut the ribbon on that stadium, I don't know if people are aware of this, but the state worked it out that UNLV gets to move in there for football. And it's been my contention that the Big Five conferences, particularly the Pac-12 and the Big 12, are going to look at that stadium and the revenue it's going to generate, and they're going to say, we're not going to let the Mountain West have all that money. I contend that either right before or right after they move into that stadium, UNLV is going to find themselves in a big boy conference. Do you agree with that?
Well, they certainly would like that, and they certainly are trying to do everything academically. They now have a medical school trying to be tier one status there, and obviously I think, like you said, the stadium, an NFL stadium, helps them athletically. Now they have to win more. They have not been good at football in forever, and they're not very good at basketball right now. So that's important for them, I think, to position themselves for a pattern. With the Pac-12, obviously, would make the most sense geographically to get into that league if, in fact, the league would want it. But it turns everything in the town. You know, with the Supreme Court ruling on the gambling, the NCAA has kind of finally come off its hypocritical stance. You're going to have a Final Four in that stadium now. You're going to have championship play of all kinds of sports in Vegas, where before you couldn't until the Supreme Court ruled a couple weeks ago. So the town is changing, and there's no question UNLV will benefit. They've got to win more, and obviously if you get into the Pac-12, I think you get better opponents, more people. But there's no question that's a game changer for them, as is for the city. You know, and I know you know Vegas. I mean, when you drive now in the 15 one way or the other 3 years from now in the nighttime and that thing is lit up, it just gives the perception that, okay, you're in a big town team. They're a big town place because
yes,
the NFL, you know, there's only 32 of them. And when you have one of them, and you have that kind of stadium and people see it, it does give the perception that you've kind of arrived sports-wise.
I'm glad you brought up the Supreme Court decision, too, because I think what it's done, and you're obviously closer to it than I am, is kind of removed the stigma in this respect. And I've got a friend who's a national sports talk show host. He worked in Vegas for a time. And he's always said the cleanest gambling in the world is in Las Vegas. They want nothing to do with anything that is even close to being dirty. And I think the Supreme Court ruling is a big step toward making people understand that. There is a perception by the uneducated that, oh, it's Las Vegas, there's got to be something underhanded. It's just the opposite, isn't it?
Completely regulated here. And they, you know, as the states decide one by one how much they're going to get into this, the regulation will be key. Now, I understand the NFL and the NBA and the NCAA wanting their piece, and ultimately maybe they get their piece. I'll be shocked if they do, because states can make their own decisions and regulate it how it wants. That's a very open-ended decision by the court. But certainly in Nevada, it's as regulated as anywhere in the world. And here's the funny part. Look, the NCAA knew that, and the NFL knew that. And the NFL finally threw up its hands and said, okay, we're coming. You take the NCAA, I mean, I do shows every year, Clay and I do shows every year, the first round of that NCAA tournament at the Westgate, where people are there at 5 in the morning, completely sold out, hour-long wait to make bets. Take betting away from the NCAA tournament, it's just another basketball tournament. And they know that. That's the thing about the NCAA.
Right.
Stupid people. They know, the NFL knows, you take fantasy football, you take gambling away from their league, what are they? They're not even a blip on the screen of what they are now. And they all understand that. It's just that they kind of rode that hypocritical stance for so long when it came to Vegas. Well, the NFL, because of their owners, wanted the money and they wanted to be in this town between Jerry Jones and Robert Kraft, who made it happen. They're in here now. And the Supreme Court made it easy for the NCAA to say, well, now we have to come because the Supreme Court has opened it up and we need to get there. And here we come. So, you know, no matter how it happened, I think those two moves certainly shone a light on the regulation and that things here are run professionally. And it just doesn't, nothing happens here. If there is any movement in any line that they believe something's happening, it is off the board in a second.
I agree. Ed, I've got 30 seconds. I want to hit on baseball for just this one quick thing. There's a new ballpark that the city is building or is being built for the AAA team in Summerlin.
Yes.
Is there
yep.
a plan somewhere in a desk drawer that if a major league team wanted to relocate, that they could expand that stadium quickly?
I think there is. The stadium's going to be out of Summerlin at Red Rock, right next to the Knights practice facility at City National. It's going to be a beautiful ballpark. Now, right now, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's 10,000 seats. Obviously, they'd have to expand. And obviously, I would think they'd have to put a top on it. I can't believe they wouldn't do that in terms of because of the summer and the heat. But maybe not. I mean, yeah, I think if you know the land out there by Red Rock, there would be an ability to do that. It's getting crunched a little with all the shopping centers and everything in the casino out there. But I think right now, in their minds, they believe the MGM took the aces in the WNBA, I think, for a lot of reasons. But one specifically, I think whether it was behind closed doors or not, there was an agreement that the MGM said, we'll take the aces, but when that next NBA team's ready to relocate, you're looking here first. Jim Muir and the MGM has literally almost promised people that the NBA will come eventually. T-Mobile is ready for that to share it with the Knights. So I think more and more people in this town are thinking way more NBA right now than they are Major League Baseball.
I understand that. Ed, I know that we're not the only ones that have asked for your time. It's been an incredible stretch for you, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you carving out some time for us. Best of luck to all of you up there in Las Vegas the rest of the way, and we'll catch up soon.
Jeff, I appreciate you asking me and having me. Take care of yourself.
You got it. Ed Graney, an outstanding columnist. The outstanding columnist in that town with the Las Vegas Review-Journal, Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Finals tonight. Okay, catch your breath. We're going to go back to basketball, and we're going to talk to our buddy Tim Kempton. Get his thoughts about the finals. And is the picture any clearer on that number one draft pick? We'll talk about it next on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Back on the Brad Sesmatch Show, Jeff Munn for Brad. Has it been busy enough for you so far? I mean, there is so much going on, and we want to talk a little bit with Suns radio analyst. And it says right here on the show sheet, good friend of the show, Tim Kempton joins us for a few minutes. Tim has survived the shock of seeing my ugly mug at 6 o'clock in the morning yesterday. So we figure if he can handle that, he can handle an interview. We want to have you on to talk about the finals, maybe whatever light we can shed on the number one pick. But I got to ask you for your thoughts. You know Brian Colangelo as well as I do and better. Just 30 seconds. Give me your thoughts on when you saw this story. What was the first thing you thought?
Don't believe it. You know, again, what I know of Brian, being around him, working with him, working for him, see what he did here in Phoenix. I can understand very, very finally why he has that one account, the one that he's owned up to having. But I just don't see why he would do it, what it benefits from him. It's totally out of character. And unfortunately now he has to prove his innocence because of all these things were thrown out there. And, you know, Jeff, it's even one of those things that I've got a couple of boys, and obviously, you know, they've been all over it because they know my relationship and everything. I would almost have to have Brian tell me he did it instead of someone else proving that he did it, because it just seems the farthest thing from my mind that Brian Colangelo would do. I don't see the benefit of him having all those accounts and bad-mouthing players and everything that they've said he's done. It just does. It makes absolutely no sense to me, knowing Brian Colangelo.
I agree with you. And obviously the coming days will bring all that into the light of day, and we'll hopefully get to the truth. All right, to the finals. I want to start first by talking about, I saw bits and pieces of Houston Golden State Game 7 on Monday, but I watched Cleveland-Boston start to finish. And the way to me that Cleveland got back in that game was when they realized there are points available right around the hoop. If we just penetrate to the basket and not worry as much about the three-pointer, we'll get back in this game. And they did. My point being, I know that there's a real emphasis on three-point shooting right now in the NBA. But there's still a lot to be gained by going right to the hoop, isn't there?
Yeah, and you have to play to your strengths. You look at those guys. You go, okay, Kyle Korver's a three-point shooter. J.R. Smith, really, really streaky. I wouldn't consider him a three-point shooter. You know, when he makes them, okay. But he's a guy that gets out on the floor, you know, finishes around the rim. Then, I mean, you just go up and down that lineup. You know, I think they play to their strength. And like you said, going to the rim, you know, slowing down the game, getting more possessions, get longer possessions. And then you have a younger team on the other side that may get rattled a little bit by the sense of, oh, man, look at what they're doing. We got to score quick, or we got to score every possession down the floor. Oh, we got to make a three here because we're down five or six. And I did. I thought their youngness or immaturity or whatever you want to call it showed a little bit in that game seven. And yeah, I just think that Cleveland played to their absolute strength of physicality, getting to the rim, getting to the free throw line, kind of making it a rough and tumble game. And that was the way they won the game, won the series.
And looking to the finals with Golden State, you touched on a couple of things I want to get a thought from you on. Number one, the only coach I have ever heard use this phrase is the coach I work with, Charlie Turner Thorne. We had a game one time a couple of years ago where she said the most important stat tonight is time of possession. And I wanted to say, hey, coach, we're not playing football. And she said, no, we need to slow this game down. We were playing Paul Westhead's team at Oregon. And she said, we got to slow this game down. We've got the surest way to keep them from doing what they want to do is not give them the ball. So the first thing I want to get a thought from you, how important is it to Cleveland to own, strange as it sounds, time of possession in this series?
That's a great point. Unfortunately, I almost don't want to say what I'm going to say, Jeff, but you and I know it's become such a huge part of the game. The officials, how is the game called?
Well, that's the other part I was going to get to.
You know, and it shouldn't be. We shouldn't be talking about the officiating. They should be on the sideline, you know, making sure that the game is played fairly, not having an input on the game. And we know in the NBA it definitely has. How is the game going to be called in that regard to the fact of, are they going to let Cleveland muck it up, slow it down as much as they can, grab, hold, slow down the cuts of Klay Thompson? Because the best team in basketball, if you're a basketball purist, if you know the game, is the Golden State Warriors, because of the way they pass the ball, the way they move bodies. They just don't stand and watch teammates. Even if someone is ISO'd, someone on the other side is setting picks and moving. So if you like that, that's the way the game's supposed to be played. You know, one-on-one is a park game that came out of boredom – of not having enough players to play five-on-five, and that's where we've gotten into this one-on-one isolation game. So, and I don't like that game when there's four of the guys on the court with you, because now the other four guys are just standing around watching you, and that's not what basketball is supposed to be. That's a little bit of a long-winded scenario there, but I just think that Golden State has too much firepower for Cleveland to control the possession of the game. You know, and luckily we have a 24-second shot clock in
right.
the NBA, so right there, that's going to force possessions from Cleveland. I guarantee you Cleveland would come down and run 48, 50 seconds off the clock if they could, if there was no shot clock, because of the disparity in the talent and disparity of the way the two teams play and the physical makeup of the two teams. So I hope the game moves up and down a little bit and we go from there and let basketball be played, not turn it into a hockey game, not turn it into a football game.
Well, to go back to Game 7 in Boston, as I'm watching the game, I'm thinking to myself, A, the officials are letting them play, and B, that's playing right into Cleveland's hands. And as you look to the finals, you mentioned the officiating. If you get a crew that lets the players play, I think that's advantage Cleveland, isn't it?
Without a doubt. And Jeff, and I'm not bagging on you, but I hate that expression. Let the players
play.
Yeah,
no, I understand.
If they let the players play, they would take all – because basketball, at the end of the day, is a skill game. It's not so much a physical game like football where you line up across from each other and try to physically move a man against his will out of the way so you can do something else. Basketball was not originally made that way. So getting back to that is, you know, I don't like it again. I've said it plenty of times. When you let players play, that's when officials take all the grabbing and holding and the physical and the hip checks and the physical play out of it to let players play. I wish we changed our vocabulary in letting players play. And another, oh, well, let the players decide the game, not the officials. Well, there was a great play in that series with Boston where Aaron Baines fouled Joel Embiid across his arms on the baseline. That's not letting the players decide. There should have been a foul there. That's getting away from the game of basketball. That's not letting the players decide the game. Aaron Baines obviously fouled Joel Embiid going up for a layup to stop him. It wasn't a good basketball play. It was just a physical play that should have been called in the rules of basketball. Because I said this yesterday when I saw you, Money.
Yes.
I played professionally for 16 years and have been around the NBA game now as a broadcaster for 16, going on 16 years. I cannot tell you what a foul is and isn't in the NBA finals right now, because I don't know when they're calling. Like the other night when Eric Gordon went to the basket in the fourth quarter, got fouled by two guys. I mean,
yeah.
How is that not a foul? They physically stopped him. Two guys did. So I do not know what a foul is or isn't in the NBA right now, the way the officials are calling or not calling these games.
I agree with you. And by the way, you can bang on me all you want. You and I are friends. You can do it to your heart's content. I got 10 seconds. I'm guessing you're going Golden State. How many games?
I think it goes quick. Five at the most, too much talent, and LeBron can't beat him one against seven, eight guys.
TK, always a pleasure. You brought up subjects I wish we had an hour to talk about, and maybe one of these days we'll get around to that. All the best to you, my friend. I'll see you soon.
All right, Jeff. Bye.
You got it. Tim Kempton, and it just, wow. He's brought up some interesting subjects, and one of these days we'll get him back on and get it a little bit deeper into the whole issue of the current state of the game as it relates to one-on-one basketball and the physicality of the game. But, man, what a day. And we're not done. Talk to the Lopes is next. Paul Coro, GCULopes.com. Way too young to be voted into the Arizona Sports Hall of Fame, but he might get there anyway. And he'll review the just completed athletic year, 17-18 for GCU. And we'll do that next on the Brad Sesmet Show. It is Wednesday. It is time for our weekly installment of Talk to the Lopes, where we visit with members of the athletic department, coaches at Grand Canyon University. But today we're going to go a little bit off track somewhat, because our guest is a writer for GCULopes.com, a gentleman I know very well, and a guy who's way too young to be on the ballot for the Arizona Sports Hall of Fame, Paul Coro, who joins us. Paul, I'm sure that you agree with me that you haven't you're not old enough yet to be voted into a Hall of Fame, right?
Very much, and not worthy. That list.
I disagree with that.
Hey, I'm sitting there between Pat Tillman and Paul Westfall in alphabetical order.
That's not bad company. That's not bad company. Well, good luck with that. I hope that works out, and you are worthy. I'll just say that right off the top. The academic or the athletic year both have come to an end, at least in terms of the regular academic year. And for GCU, first year of Division I eligibility. And among other things, they win the WAC Commissioners Cup, and really they've been in the running for it before, Paul. But I know that this year they did get credit for their tournament finishes, which makes it more legitimate in terms of how they finished.
Yeah, be going through the Division I probation period. This was the first season where they got to be in those WAC tournaments, and kind of almost ran away with it, won it by more than 11 points. It had been the New Mexico State Cup, basically, for the previous 3 years, and New Mexico State continued to be the challenger that finished runner-up. But just an across-the-board success rate, especially given its young status in Division I, was really startling for a lot of people for them to have that kind of success early and a blanket their success in a lot of ways, you know, ending with baseball, winning the regular season title again, back-to-back, and having a lot of things along the way, like track going back-to-back in men's and women's, indoor and outdoor, for titles. Women's golf won its WAC championship and took a team to the NCAA regionals. So just a lot of things that have laid the groundwork for expectations for even more down the line.
I want to talk about baseball for a minute, because I wrote a column last week for Brad's for the website, sports360az.com. After talking with the coach at Florida Atlantic, and he is in Conference USA, and he does not like conference tournaments, I started thinking about the WAC, and I looked at Grand Canyon. They finished 19-5. They won 2 of 3 from their closest pursuers, both from New Mexico State and Sacramento State. And I raised the question, does a mid-major really need to do a conference tournament? Because in baseball, now I think basketball is different, but in baseball, and look, we all know what happened. Grand Canyon was 2 and out in the WAC tournament over the weekend, missed out on going to the NCAA tournament. But I still say maybe this isn't the fairest way for the WAC to determine who is the best representative. If you're a one-bid league, this is just my opinion, I don't think you need to do a conference tournament. What is the sense? And I don't want to say now, because obviously it was a painful experience. What was the sense among Andy Stankiewicz's the coaching staff, the administration going into the WAC tournament that, gee, why do we have to go back and prove ourselves all over again? Was that the feeling?
Yeah, I couldn't certainly speak for everybody on this matter. And like you said, in retrospect, it certainly looks just like a bitter taste if you say, oh, there shouldn't be a tournament after they went 2 and out. But it certainly didn't give a representative view of the team that was the best over the long haul. For a second straight season, they didn't lose a conference series. And like you said, they took 2 of 3 against the teams that wound up in the championship round. So it's really difficult. Now, I will say there's some other factors there. You know, there's not home and homes with every team. So some teams have an inherent advantage, but with scheduling against certain teams, you want to incentivize the back half of the season and keep teams playing hard because they're still battling for seeding. But there certainly seems like there should be an easier path, not an easier path, a rewarding path for the teams that dominated over the long haul. GCU did not play like the team it had been all year. They had become a top 20 national team in batting and just didn't hit like that in those two games. But somebody like Jake Wong was as great as ever on that stage and went 11 strikeouts over eight innings and gave up no earned runs, and that's frustrating. And it's particularly frustrating when Ethan Ivanko, who has had a spectacular senior year coming back from Tommy John and been one of the best pitchers in WAC, he didn't even get to throw because they only had the two games.
Paul Coro from GCU Lopes joining GCULopes.com joining us on Talk to the Lopes, our weekly feature here on Sports360AZ.com and the Brad Sesmat Show. The new facilities for baseball and softball, obviously it were big winners in terms of attendance. I would also think that from an administrative standpoint, it gets a little easier on both programs to get non-conference opponents to come to GCU because the facilities are better, the crowds are going to be bigger. An established D1 program is not going to want to come play in a bandbox. That's not a problem at GCU now.
Yeah, and you saw that immediately. Both teams, softball opened with the national champions, Oklahoma, and baseball opened with TCU for a three-game series. So, and there were many other teams on both that came in that were Power Fives or ranked teams that came through because especially for teams that are from different climates, they like to come to the Southwest to try to get some games in early, and a lot of them are coming through to face other teams, whether it be Arizona or Arizona State or elsewhere in California. So it becomes part of a swing for them to play quality teams. And they know what each of them has done. Ann Pearson's done a great job with the softball program over the years. And they made a run to the championship round of the WAC championship. So and each of those, like every team in the program, but those two specifically have really raised the bar as far as scheduling, and they're going after the top teams. They want to play the best and prepare themselves. And, there is a mindset that can be a one big league, but I think there's an idea that if they continue to schedule as strong as they can, that they can raise their RPI even better. And then that attracts better opponents too, when your RPI is strong to face the teams that don't want to be hurt by a low RPI team.
Let's look ahead to next year now. As I said, we're done with the competition for 17-18. A lot of basketball programs around the country are starting to formulate or have formulated their non-conference schedules. We know about the Jerry Colangelo tournament coming that GCU will be involved in. Is there anything else that we can shed light on in regards to Dan Marley's schedule? And I don't want to leave Nicole Powell out of this either, about either one of their non-conference schedules at this point.
Yeah, the men's basketball schedule is going to be released very soon, so I don't want to jump ahead on that.
You don't have to. No, that's all right. I get it.
You've seen some of the early ones come out, and it's definitely overall going to be an upgrade as far as who they see, where they go. They've already been announced as part of the Wooden Legacy Classic that'll be at Fullerton, and there's tournament quality teams in that one. Dan Marley's shown a willingness to go where he needs to go to play quality teams, and they know that it's getting tougher and tougher to get high-ranked teams to come in here to play with the environment they've created. And, at one point St. Mary's was supposed to come in and that came off the schedule. So they've made it a point that they're going to go out and find the games that they want to play at a higher level.
What is anything we can talk about in regards to women's basketball? Because Nicole Powell now has gotten through her first year, has gotten settled in. But my sense was that everybody at GCU was very, very pleased with that first year performance. Is there anything that we can shed any light on about her schedule for next year?
Yeah, well, she's had she inherited an incredible schedule, where they played Duke and Rice right at the beginning. And so they weren't messing around with that. And, she's one of her toughest coaching jobs will be the year to come because she lost two top scorers in Bree Modling, Jessica Gajewski. So she and the staff have been working really hard with recruiting. And it's almost to the point where In year two, she's already got a roster that's very much her own. And, they've got another one still out to finalize, but you'll hear that class being announced pretty soon, and it'll be a big impact class in a lot of ways, and they'll start getting more of their stamp on it. But, yeah, it's part of what she wants too, and they'll go places and try to get in bigger tournaments, but they also can attract people here, and they want to create an environment at GCU Arena that is positive for women's basketball on this side of town. Obviously, Charlie Turner Thorne's done a great job at Arizona State, and you know, they both couple Stanford people coaching in town have raised the bar, and she got the team to the WAC semifinals, and really was just a couple plays away from being the WAC was very balanced, and for a first year staff inheriting a lot of things, they took that team about as far as they could, but they were right on the same bar as all the other teams in the Final Four there.
And when we look at the fall, there's obviously going to be volleyball, but I guess the one that gets the most attention, I don't know if that's the right term to use, but the one that I know that we'll hear about probably first is men's soccer, both soccer programs, and at their facility, which is, if you're on the campus, you can see it from just about anywhere, and that'll be here before we know it.
Yeah, and there'll be a lot of excitement for that. You know, the men's soccer program had two players, Nikki Jackson and Amir. I'm always going to struggle with his name. Sajercevic, I think. Both got drafted in the MLS, and you see Nikki Jackson already score in his first game there. So, you know, Grand Canyon soccer is already on the map. They have some more recruits coming in. They schedule very strongly. They've got a lot of return visits on some tough road games they had last year, so those have some quality home games as well. And then with women's soccer, you know, they were the first program in the whole athletic department to record a WAC tournament win, sort of historic in this new Division I era anyway, because baseball, of course, had been there in the deep past. But that women's soccer team, it had a lot of freshmen playing on that team, so there's expectations for them to take another big step because they were at one point starting mostly freshmen.
Paul Coro, GCULopes.com. There'll be plenty to write about during the summer leading up to the start of the fall sports. But I have one burning question that only you can answer, my friend. Who's responsible for looking after Butel this summer?
Man, he's got a lot on his plate. You know,
I know.
Everybody knows him as the voice of the Lopes, and he's got those big pipes that everybody hears during basketball games. That makes it real exciting. Does a great job across the department with GCU TV and covering all the athletic departments. But he's taken on a lot of other responsibilities in this new era of GCU as it moves into nonprofit. And I guess that is that my job. I got to keep an eye on Barry.
No, it's probably a combo job between Michael Potter, Tom Kuiper, Scott Williams, all those guys. I'll tell you a little story about Barry. When he was at Fox Sports Arizona years and years ago when the D-backs started, every time I'd see him, I'd say, there goes the hardest working man in show business. And now at GCU, he's kind of taken that to another level. It's like, gosh, I didn't think you could work, you know, put in more hours in a day, but he must be working 30-hour days over there.
Yeah, you're right about that. He squeezes everything out of it, and he's really devoted to the university and knows it just about as well as anybody on campus. And, you know, I feel fortunate that we work directly on a lot of these things, getting out the good stories about athletes. You know, it's not all about the people that have great success on the field. There's a lot of good stories to be told about athletes and how they get here and what they've overcome to do it. So we like to highlight the big ones, but we also like to highlight all the good tales about what it takes to be a GCU student and what this campus does for people.
Well, and as I said, you've got plenty to keep you busy this summer with all the stories that you have available to you. And I really do wish you well with the Hall of Fame. I know you're a modest guy. You're never going to get all hepped up about please vote for me, but you certainly deserve it. And on a personal level, I'm glad you're doing well. And we haven't talked in a while, and I just am glad to see that you're going great guns over there at GCU and hope things keep going on that upward path. Paul, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks, Munster. Just a couple Westsiders still getting it done.
You
huh?
Got that right, pal. Westside. Good to talk to you. Paul Coro, GCULopes.com. And as we said, throughout the summer, leading up to the fall sports, GCULopes.com obviously will have lots of great things to read about the student athletes and all the other goings on in GCU athletics. GCU's Talk to the Lopes here on Sports360AZ.com and the Brad Sesmatch Show each and every Wednesday.